Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
So, President Trump, we set the name of the Lord upon you, and we declare that no weapon formed against you will prosper, that every tongue that rises up against you in judgment will be condemned. And if God be for you, who can be against you? We bless you, President Trump, in Jesus' name.
That was one of the opening invocations to the rally the night before the inauguration at the Capital One Arena in Washington.
David, I'm glad to hear your voice. I thought I was expecting to hear the, like, Oral Roberts or Jimmy Swaggart just now, rather than like yours. But this is Hacks on Tap.
I'm running it as a cautionary note to both of you guys.
Yeah, our tongues may be smote. Yeah,
if exactly. You don't watch yourselves on this podcast and all future podcasts for the next 4 years, you may find yourself in a pile of ashes.
You know, we are going to have the first Old Testament presidency, I guess. it is something, you know, the other kind of callback to that was when Vance did the inaugural dance to Battle Hymn of the Republic.
I've never seen anybody dance to that before.
Yeah, no, it's one of his favorites. The Horst Wessel song, too, he's a little fond of. But anyway, I digress.
The man's got moves. The man's got moves, and he wants to show them off.
Well, he does have moves. He's 40 years old, and he's vice president of the United States. Yeah, that's pretty fast moving. So anyway, guys, it's here we are. We're in the day two of the Trump presidency here. I guess it's really day one, full day, but he had a full day yesterday.
Jesus. Talk about bread and circuses.
You know, the thing with Trump is you get kind of consumed by all of the, you know, the grievances and the gracelessness, but then you have to step back and say, if you were sitting over there, how would you feel about that day? And they had they wanted to connote action. They wanted to they wanted to look like they were on the move on the things that he had said he was going to do. They had this, kind of pile of executive actions. But the main thing was, and we'll talk about those, he was in action. And I think they wanted to set a contrast with Biden.
Oh, totally. Totally. You know, they just, that was the MAGA victory celebration, happy Trump, the Coke buttons back on the desk. And they did this whole flutter of combination of like campaign press release type crap. I hereby set up a task force to stop inflation and real stuff. So it was action man. Boom, 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 boom. They had a good day from their point of view.
Yeah.
From the countries, we don't know.
We can get to what the countries in a second. But we are hacks, so I'm just hacking it up here on that element of it.
This one's hard, though. I'm hacking up phlegm. This one is tough. That was a tough day to watch.
I hear you. I have the same concerns. But Heilman, I mean, there was a moment last night because, you know, he did event after event after event. So and one of them was, you know, they delayed the announcement of him completely pardoning all of the J6, what he calls hostages. In fact, he said that in front of the families of Israeli hostages, which I thought was kind of tasteless.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, taste wasn't really the high lantern of yesterday.
No. But he goes over to the Oval and he's signing and he has the media in there and he's doing like running commentary. And
that was the best part. It was totally revealing.
They should have called it the fake talk express, Murphy, because it reminded me of your campaign with McCain. Everybody sitting around. It was like open mic night.
Right. No, it was. I thought it was the most. Luckily, I was on a plane, so I read the transcript and then I watched bites of the actual speech and then the rallies and all. But I found myself glued last night to the nonstop open mic coverage of signing. I mean, he had the lickspittle there. Give me one of those. What does that one do? Oh, and then they do the Frank Luntz thing. You know, it's not a haircut. It's follicle reform. Well, we're going to reform the SAS. That's code for let the political thugs muscle the civil servants around. Right. You know, all right, that'll be a good one. Oh, this is a biggie here, World War III.
Yeah. No, they'd bring him these things, and he'd go, wow. You know, we're pulling out of the World Health Organization. Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Goodbye, Mississippi. It's going to be the mighty Trump River now. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Where I was going was there was one really revealing moment where he said, hey, Biden ever do this? You ever have any press conferences like this?
I know.
Did he ever not know what he's signing?
Well, I mean, look, it's weird to see my colleagues in the press be so deferential to Trump in that room. Like, you know, Biden never had a press conference where people were constantly yelling at him. And I say that not as a Biden partisan, but I mean, the press was very quiet and like letting Trump proceed at his own pace and control the room. I mean, I don't know how long that'll last, but I feel like yesterday, until he got back to the Oval to sign those executive orders, was like a tale of like two speeches, right? There was the speech he gave, the official inaugural, and then there was the alt inaugural, right? Where the difference was between like yacht rock Trump versus like speed metal Trump. And the second one, the one in the visitor center, was the one that he really wanted to give. In fact, he kept saying that, you know, well,
yeah, this one's better.
Here's all the things I really wanted to say until Melania and J.D. Vance held me back. The biggest tell of the entire thing was the moment when he said, and Melania said to me, sir, don't put all that stuff in this beautiful speech. And then he realized that it blew off his whole thing, which is he always says, she came to me with tears in her eyes. And she said, sir. And then he said, well, she calls me sir when she's mad at me. And then he realized, okay, I'm really in trouble here. Rare moment when Trump goes, I'm just kidding, okay? The press is going to be all over me if I don't acknowledge that. I just made that up. And those two, you know, he does one speech, which is like sedated Trump. Where the best rhetoric in it, you know, you compare it with malice towards none and charity for all. The only thing to fear is fear itself. That's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill is like, you know, that's a bad speech. It's like laundry listy, but do they feel good about it? I'm sure they did.
He could have at least done with charity with malice for all and charity for none.
For none, right, exactly. But I think, but to your point, David, I think they thought, you know, it looked like he was in, I mean, signing all those executive orders in public, you know, doing that action man. And then he gets to do all of his venting about that feeds the base and talks about, you know, how the election was stolen and blah, blah, blah. So then, but that you got to that third act. And I mean, just on the politics of it, forget about like, put aside for the moment, the substantive critique, a withering substantive critique that one might want to offer for what he did with the pardons of the J6 convicts. Is that good politics in
no.
the long run? Is that? It just doesn't seem like good politics
no.
for Donald
no,
Trump.
No. Trump. Look, Trump is an interesting animal. He's formidable on the outside, pissing in. You know, he's won two campaigns that way. Once he's on the inside, he gets in trouble. You know, hence he lost to Biden in the reelect. So we'll just see how this turns out. From their MAGA point of view, he had the action man Trump show he wanted. Gonna grow old. Because he's got expectations. And by the way, the Canadian embassy, and I'll finish with this, David, I read in the Post this morning, they were having a big rooftop party. Woohoo! Hey, no tariffs, hey! And then the first thing you did, oh yeah, February 1, we're going to rain hellfire.
Yeah.
You know, so let's just see what we get here, because I think that sign-a-thon was the tell. That's who he is.
The only quibble I'd have with you is he was doing pretty well for 3 years politically. You know, despite the impeachment and all of that, you know, he beat the impeachment back, and he was doing okay until the pandemic came along and he had to deal with a real crisis.
I mean, he did get his ass kicked in the midterms in 2018. Exactly.
That's true.
Yeah. He had about a good 17 months.
Yeah, the party never prospered under Trump. The party didn't prosper in 17, 18 19 or 20, the party didn't prosper under Trump. Trump was doing okay with his personal approval ratings. He was doing okay.
I'll tell you something. You talk about prospering. I think that the most dangerous time for Trump is when he's feeling prosperous, when he's feeling hubris, and you know, when he and right now,
oh, he God, feels yes.
he feels like he has beaten back the most determined effort to destroy him. And he has returned to Washington, you know, as a conqueror.
He's not wrong.
Though I'll tell you, one more point on expectation. That Action Man stuff does crank up expectations. Mm-hmm. Because now, okay, deliver. Because some of that stuff was, like, ridiculous. But to his world, it's like, well, he solved that. He just signed a piece of paper. Now no more inflation.
Mike, he sat there. He sat there in the Oval Office and maintained that he could repeal part of the United States Constitution by right. signing an executive order. It's the, I mean, talk about raising unrealizable expectations. Even right. this Supreme Court is not going to buy on, going to buy sign off on that.
That is true. A bunch of what he signed is going to be contested. But, you know, I always remember the story about Trump when they came to him about the tax cut, and they said, you know, this is going to create much bigger deficits, and, you know, it's going to create add to the debt. And he said, hey, that's someone else's problem. We're not going to be here when they have to deal with that. So his thing is, let's just win the day, okay? We're winning the day here. It looks like we're doing stuff. And frankly, look, you know, his challenge on the 14th Amendment is pretty interesting, because basically what he's saying is people who come here illegally, their children should not be American citizens.
Right, so-called birthright citizenship, which yes. we have now, and he wants to undo it with a felt-tip pen,
oh, but on it is a constitutional on, but here's my point. He's doing it in a surgical way. So if you polled the American people and said, should the children of illegal immigrants who were born here after they come here, should they become citizens? I'm not sure how that would poll.
I think it's a 50% issue. I think somebody went through it yesterday with me and said that the polling, you know, getting rid of criminal illegal immigrants is super popular now. Getting rid of all illegal immigrants is a more than 50% issue. Ending birthright citizenship is right at about 50. And the only thing that he wants to do in immigration that's not a majority issue is ending DACA. It's the only one that's like about 40.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. The Wall Street Journal poll had overall 57%. I'm sorry, where is this? Oh, 64-31 against reversing birthright citizenship.
Well, that would be encouraging if true.
And the polling is a little fungible, because it's how yes, you frame it.
Totally.
You know, when it's a high school quarterback who can't go to college now because he came here as a one-year-old without documentation, that story moves numbers one way. The kind of dry description of should people who broke into this country illegally looking for the free stuff, the welfare, should they be, then it's another cut. But I take your point, David. He's fighting on good ground for him on this immigration stuff. It's a winner for him.
Yeah, on some of it. But my point is only that, I think that someone over there is trying to craft this stuff in ways that they think will get them closest to being advantaged. And just looking, you know, the thing he can deliver on most quickly is the border stuff and deporting, you know, criminals. And no matter how many he deports, he'll do it noisily. And he'll say it's the biggest deportation ever. And it doesn't matter how many he deports. I mean, the truth is, and we got a lot of crap for it, but we, during the Obama administration, he actually prioritized the deportation of people who had committed crimes.
Yeah, he started in Chicago, so he'll get credit for that. God knows.
Yeah,
it'll be a hit to the voter rolls, but we're, you know.
All right, okay, good. We got it in early. Let the record show that 15 minutes in, he got the Chicago. Yeah. Voting joking.
It's a new year.
I sort of teed it up for him. I didn't want Mike to go without on this episode.
But think about it. Here's the funny thing about this deporting criminal. And I'm all for deporting criminals. I'm for deporting some Americans, frankly. I've got a list. A bunch of them were at the inaugural.
I was going to say, but, most of Trump's cabinet.
Yeah, I got a lot of ideas. I'll trade a Mexican carpenter for three or four MAGA undersecretaries of commerce in a minute.
Just give me this for one second. Kara Swisher said to me the other day, she's like, I think Elon would be a good president of Mars.
Like, well, you know, he did give the Romulan Star Empire salute. Real Trekkies understand what that was. The East Germans of space. No, but all right. So I'm Frederico the Killer Axelrod, and I'm locked up in San Quentin, and they're going to deport me because I'm a criminal. So now I'm out of H Block, and I'm in Mexico. It's easier to break into the country than it is to break out of San Quentin. So net, I want to make that ironic point, because I often think now in the new era we're entering, like, you know, about escaping from prisons and that sort of thing. And it just, I don't know, we've entered a Kafka-esque funhouse mirror thing now. There aren't words.
Okay, let's take a break right here for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Missing out on a TV show that everyone's talking about is not an option for me. I'm constantly signing up for this streaming service or that streaming service. I sign up for every streaming service. I got them all, man.
My wife reminds me of this all the time.
Yes, there's not one I feel like I can live without. And then a few months later, I realize, you know, I've been paying for the service long after I finished the particular show.
So what do you do, John?
Well, I get Rocket Money. I got Rocket Money, and that was like, you know, I'll use a phrase I've used before. It was a game changer for me. Rocket Money goes through, changes the game. They find your unwanted subscriptions and even help you cancel them, so you never have to worry about those unwanted subscriptions slipping through the cracks. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel those unwanted subscriptions. They pile up on your phone. They pile up on your TV service. They pile up. And Rocket Money will monitor your spending, help you lower your bills so you can grow your savings.
So I guess how it works is they see all your subscriptions in one place, and they know exactly where your money is going, which is going to stun you when you find out. For ones you don't want anymore, Rocket Money can help you cancel them, which I desperately need. Rocket Money's dashboard, I'm told, gives you a clear view of your expenses across all your accounts. Get alerts if bills increase in price, there's unusual spending activity, or if you're close to going over budget.
And you know what? The really most awesome thing is, David, that Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you.
Yeah,
they automatically scan your bills to find opportunities to save, and then you can ask them to negotiate for you. They'll deal with the customer service so that you don't have to. I know you hate dealing with customer service reps.
Hate it.
Rocket Money knocks that right out.
Especially when they're bots.
Yeah, no kidding.
Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions. Yeah, $500 million, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features.
You know, David, that $500 million, you know, they could very quickly, if they get you signed up.
Yeah, that's your net worth right there.
I was going to say, if they get you signed up, they could probably like double that number in just by dealing with the Axelrod unused subscription account thing.
Yeah, that's right. Probably true.
So here's the deal. Cancel your unwanted, useless, past their sell-by date subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money. Go to rocketmoney.com/hacks today. That's rocketmoney.com/hacks. Sign up. You'll be glad you did.
That's rocketmoney.com/hacks. rocketmoney.com/hacks.
So I have a question for you guys about this, to go to David's point about fighting on turf that's favorable to him. I think we'd all agree that fighting on the immigration turf is favorable to him, even though, you know, the two things he declared national emergencies yesterday were on energy and on immigration. On the merits, you could argue that there was an immigration emergency a couple of years ago. I'm saying you could argue as in, I think there was an immigration emergency. It's not really, the numbers don't really justify that now, but it's still favorable political turf. Can you guys explain to me why he thinks energy at this moment is favorable political turf for him? Because I get it when gas prices were sky high, but like, there's no one right now who thinks that drill baby drill has the same resonance at this moment that it did a couple few years ago.
He gave some tells during his open mic thing with the signing. He's like a mercantile guy. How many pounds of coal do we export and what do we bring in? So he thinks if we, and his oil guys tell him this, if we drill like crazy and have massive exports of petroleum, we become the new Saudi. We ship petroleum abroad and the balance of payments gets better. So his little, he even said it, well, here's how they get out of the tariffs. They buy American oil. Because we're going to have so much American oil, and that'll fix the balance of payments. And, you know, he, let's put it this way. The guy never showed up for an econ class at Penn. And I'll tell you, the bone spurs.
Okay, it's ludicrous. We can become the new Saudi.
Yeah, that's his big plan. No, he loves it. And, of course, he'd have a monarchy. It all fits together.
Someone named Donald Trump showed up for the econ class, but it wasn't him.
It wasn't him. It yeah. wasn't him. So, you know, it's the old story about if Trump had taken his inheritance and put it in an index fund, he'd be a lot richer. Every time he ran his own money, he would, you know, the whole Trump, the business genius thing is a fraud. But he got back into the tariff business yesterday. And he kept going back to it. It's like the kid and the finger in the electric socket. Oh, we told him not to. And he keeps trying. So Feb 1.
Does he really not understand that it is impossible to impose taxes in other countries?
Yeah, well, you impose it on our consumers. So, you know, everything you buy.
But that's what I'm saying. But he keeps saying, no, our consumers aren't going to pay for it. We're going to impose the tariffs in these other countries. And you're like, dude, we're going to set up tariff offices and we're going to affect the laws of all these sovereign nations.
Well, that was one of his EOs. He said, we're going to have the Department of External Revenue because they're going to be there at the docks of Canada taking engine parts on the way to the Chrysler plant and doubling the price. So your car costs $90,000.
Yes. And tariffs, by the way, are not all that popular, and they're in the same polling. I'm looking for the number here, but people believe that 68% say that tariffs will make things more expensive. The biggest gap in Axios had a word cloud of the subjects that he dealt with. The economy actually got very little space in his inaugural speech, and it's the thing that he's most going to be
judged on.
Yeah. Back to my thing about the ticking clock on this guy.
Yeah, no, that's I know, but as I said to you offline yesterday,
yeah, it's funny. Go.
You've been predicting his doom, and you know it gets to the, you know, maybe the stop clock is right once every 24 hours.
Like Kreskin, you just keep doing it. And you hit a few. You watch.
I think we have to recognize that, and we'll get to the J6 stuff and so on, but. This guy, whatever else he is the best brander, marketer, and salesman that we've probably had there, in the sense that he just, you know, Alyssa Farah Griffin told this story on the air once. She said she went into his office one day. He said, go out and tell him this. She said, well, that's not true. And he said, if you say it enough, they'll believe it is.
Right.
Yeah, he borrowed that from somebody else, but yeah.
The guy's still, I agree. You won't get me to disagree, David, with the notion, which we've said on the show many times and in other places, that, you know, that there's a kind of feral genius to Trump. And he definitely, I mean, look, the guy won the second most votes of any presidential candidate in the history of the country in 2024.
After leaving the Washington in well-deserved disgrace, yes, and being indicted four,
yes,
times.
So I give the man his due. He won this election. He won it fair and square. We know how many counties shifted towards Trump. It's a real phenomenon. He still got 49.9% of the vote. And any president that you guys worked for, an incoming president with 49.9, you would do what George W. Bush did back in 2001, which was like, hey, if I want to get some big things done, I got to convince some people who didn't vote for me to support me.
Right.
That's the way anybody you guys ever worked for or advised would approach this. And all I heard was base material yesterday in the official inaugural, in the alt inaugural, and from behind the desk in the Oval Office. It's all just base servicing. I just don't see how that gets you to, if you're such a brilliant marketer and brander, you'd think you might at this point be able to start to expand your coalition.
My point is that this guy has been selling horseshit products for his whole life.
Whole life, yeah.
I mean, steaks and vodka and universities and all that stuff.
I agree, but I'll push back on this a little.
All right, go ahead.
No, he's a great flim-flam man. I would say he's not a brilliant marketer. I would say he's the most brilliant moron wrangler in American history, and there are more morons to wrangle now. Trump's formula for victory has two components. One, Trump destroys norms and goes out there and says all this crazy stuff, and a whole lot of people, particularly morons, believe it. The second thing is he needs a Democratic failure. He needs a Biden. He needs a Hillary. Where his stuff punches through. Because, you know, you're right about George Bush and people before him. They look at the machinery and say, all right, I'm a 49% guy. I got to triangulate. I did it as governor. I got to get some Dems. Trump is, I got to smash the machine and build one so I can do whatever I want and just grab power. And he's a power politician like we've always had. He doesn't care about norms or institutions or the franchise. He's just like, what do I get and take?
The most dangerous thing about Trump is that he genuinely does not believe in rules and laws and norms and institutions.
Yeah.
Thinks they're for suckers, thinks the world, and we've said it here before, thinks the world is the Hunger Games and the strong take what they want. I was listening to Ian Bremmer this morning somewhere, and he was saying that, you know, the danger for the world is that for the first time, like America is actually destroying the global architecture that it created.
Right. The post-war period is unbelievable. I want to play a clip from the Sign-a-thon that I think is super revealing about TikTok.
If you're not guaranteeing that TikTok will be around after 90 days from today.
No, but it could very well be. It makes sense for it to be because it's got tremendous value. But if we create the value by approving, you know, in other words, that approval gives it tremendous value. If that's the case, then we should be entitled to 50% as a country. You understand? You haven't heard that one before, right? That's called a joint venture.
He went on to say, I got a lot of rich people calling me.
Right. Right. It's so Trump. So we got this TikTok national security and mind-bending problem. We're in a standoff with the Chinese, and he's thinking, well, wait a minute. I can turn this into commerce. You know, I got leverage here. Nothing there's about the national interest, always the TikTok problems, kids' brains. No. I smell a hustle here. I happen to own all the ice cubes on a hot day.
I agree.
So, you know, it's unbelievable, but it is core Trump. That's the firmware there. You just heard it, how he looks at the leverage thing.
He talked about Kim Jong-un, and he said he's got...
And Gaza, beautiful real estate.
Condo. Had a lot of great condos there.
Yeah.
I once traveled in the Piedmont region in Italy and watched dogs that were trained to find truffles in the earth. They would run across the frozen earth for 100 yards. They'd find a spot. They'd start to dig, and then they'd pull a truffle out of the earth. That is Donald Trump at a grift. The man can sniff a grift out at 100 yards under 10 feet of frozen tundra. You know, that's Mike, to your point.
Yes.
I mean, and it's amazing because it's essentially like, hey, you know what? Let's take over TikTok. My son and my friend Elon are basically already running Twitter. And on top of that, I've got my own cryptocurrency now. The guy on the eve of becoming the president of the United States has issued his own currency from which he will directly profit. It's the griftiest grift of all grifts.
Yeah, and $14 billion in sales. And you know, it's gone down. Like CNBC did a great story on it. He is, but here's the problem for the country beyond the, I agree with you totally, the atomic clock of grifting. I mean, Madoff is spinning in his grave embarrassed at this stuff, but he's got grift cataracts. He only can see the grift. He looks at TikTok, sees a grift and nothing else when there are much bigger national interest issues here. He looks at Gaza and he says, who can get the land on the rebuild as long as I cut my kid in for some beachfront condos, the deal I want to make with the North Korean dictator who causes famine for his own people. I mean, he only sees the grip, tunnel vision.
Yeah, he and Melania both issued Bitcoin meme coins.
She had tears in her eyes when she did it. She called him, said she referred to him as sir.
Yeah, again, moron selling. Now morons are going to lose money on it.
I love that title. It might be the title of my next book.
This is actually part of the problem for Democrats, actually, because I think a lot of Democrats would embrace exactly what you just said, Mike. And the question is, I think there are a lot of people. He does have a core third of the vote. I mean, that's as his base. There are a lot of people who voted for Trump who had lots of reservations about Trump, but they have big reservations about paying 20% more than they were a few years ago. And they saw Biden.
So
I don't think it's necessarily moronic to say, I'm not doing very well here. Maybe this guy can help.
When you cannot fill the vacuum with a Democratic candidate who's not a train wreck, yes, the pain has nowhere else to go because they're voting for change. They're not voting for Trump. And it's totally legitimate. I have a lot of friends who voted for Trump, I get it. But if I don't think he's the sophisticated.
Tell them you're not calling them morons.
No, but you're deconstructing my thing in a wrong way.
Okay.
I'm saying Trump is really good at making politics really stupid to capture simple grievance. That's what I mean by moron wrangling. And the Democrats give him half the win every time. Because the Democrats are no longer a functional, appealing national political party anymore. They nominate the Hillarys and the Bidens stick around with a cover-up. And then the Kamala Harris, who's a ridiculous choice ultimately for any hard-headed strategic way to win election.
We don't have to
I'm doing my speech here and I'll wrap it up.
I like David's read on Murphy's thing better because it made for a minute I was imagining Mike as like a resistance mom. All these Americans are all such morons.
Yes.
Well, there's plenty of it.
You can take the boy out of MSNBC, but you can't take the MSNBC out of the boy.
Look, I quit MSNBC for a reason.
Boo.
Again.
Okay, then let's take a break right here, and we'll be right back.
Hey, so David, one of the reasons that I decided to join Hacks on Tap was because you kept singing the praises of one of the show's advertisers. That's Helix, because you're like in love with your Helix mattress. And I have never found a mattress I like in my whole life. So like, what's so great about this Helix mattress?
Don't get me going. Yeah. I mean, everybody who listens to this podcast knows that I tried the mattress out because, you know, we want to be straight up with our listeners about the products that we're talking about. And it was a revelation to me. I mean, the mattress came sort of freeze-wrapped, delivered to my home. You unwrap it, it expands. And because they give you a quiz and can get a sense of what your sleeping habits are, the thing is really tailor-made to you. And it turns out it's one of the great mattresses that I've ever had. You know, and I've had it for several years now, and I'm as happy as could be.
Now, is there some particular problem you're trying to solve? Because God knows, like, when people go through the problems that people have with sleeping, like snoring, back pain, you know, not being able to make it through the night without having to go to pee, you know, sleeping too hot, sleeping too cold. I have all those problems, every single one of them.
Yeah, no, I do as well. I do too, and sleep apnea. I have all those things. I'm not a good sleeper. I do sleep better on this mattress. I'm more comfortable on this mattress. I really highly recommend it. So go to helixsleep.com. Take their quiz, get something that's tailor-made to you, but this will sweeten it. Give them the offer, man.
27% off site-wide if you go to Helix Sleep, that's HelixSleep.com/hacks, HelixSleep.com/hacks. You get 27% off site-wide, and on top of that, 2 free Dream Pillows with your mattress purchase as part of the MLK flash sale. Got to do this now, okay? That's helix.com/hacks for 27% off site-wide and those 2 dreamy, free dream pillows with your mattress purchase. Just talk for a second about the J6 pardons thing, because that was another moment I thought was incredible in the Oval Office, because Trump basically in that moment in the Oval Office was like, These Biden pardons are really, I mean, he basically was like, oh, it's totally inappropriate for him to pardon all these people as he's about to pardon people who beat cops with baseball bats.
Well, let's talk about that because, yes, what he did was egregious, and they knew it was egregious, which is why they waited until the dark of night to do it.
Sure.
So it did. They didn't step on their own story. Pardon them all. Pardon the Proud Boy leader. Pardon the Oath Keeper leader, both of whom had, you know, long prison sentences. And this was after, let me just play this clip. This is after J.D. Vance announced to the country the other day on Face the Nation this.
If you protested peacefully on January the 6th and you've had Merrick Garland's Department of Justice treat you like a gang member, you should be pardoned. If you committed violence on that day, obviously you shouldn't be pardoned. And there's a little bit of a gray area there, but we're very much committed to seeing the equal administration of law. And there are a lot of people, we think, in the wake of January the 6th who were prosecuted unfairly. We need to rectify that.
All right. So there you have it. Someone didn't clue him in.
And Pam Bondi in her confirmation hearing basically said the same thing.
Yeah. So this is what the rumor that was out there yesterday, you guys. A prominent Republican told me that he was told 2 hours before this announcement that Trump, they were originally to go with a more discreet list of parole, pardon recipients. And after the Biden thing, Trump said, screw it, I got cover here. Let's just go for the whole thing. Now, I don't know if that's bullshit or not.
Well, it's not smart politics. This one's a mistake for him.
Say why, Murphy.
Well, he might have found 100 martyrs who were little old ladies on their way to a prayer meeting and got sucked into the crowd, and he can go bang up. There are going to be some bad apples in this 1600. There are people trying to kill cops, and they're going to be famous now. We're going to take another look at the top 20 of them. And it's going to be a rogues gallery. And now the news cycle is, this is going to go on for a bit. Who were they? What happened? There will be outrage. It's a bad bet. He's supposed to fix the economy, not release thugs.
57% of Americans oppose these pardons. And the number is higher in the 60s when you talk about people who assault the police. Yeah. But the question is, I mean, remember, they voted for a guy who instigated and fired these people to go there and do what they did.
And David, who promised over and over again he was going to do this thing throughout the campaign. He didn't make I was there at Waco for that first campaign event when I saw when he did something he would then do for months thereafter, which was get the J6 choir version of the national anthem and stand up with his hand over his heart. It was truly one of the most surreal and dispiriting things I've ever seen at a presidential campaign event. And yet he did it for a year and a half and still performed better than he's ever performed in a national election. So I don't think people voted for that, but I think that they didn't give a shit enough to vote against him for it.
Well, no, they cared about other things more.
Yeah, they voted to fire Joe Biden, fix the economy, and they thought she was a wackadoodle San Francisco.
But that's just another way. That's just another way of saying they didn't care enough about this.
Yes,
have it be disqualified for Trump.
Well, that's the thing about Trump. They're such a word salad. You don't read the fine print a lot. You read the fire Biden part, but you get the fine print. Now you sign the car lease, and guess what? What do you mean the payment's $1,800 a month and no service?
One thing they did read was, I'm going to get your cost down quickly.
Right.
They did read that. And if he doesn't do that, all these other things will become much more vexing for him. If he does do it, I think there'll be a lot of forgiveness for some of his other trespasses.
I agree.
Here. So we'll
so
see what
happens.
So that's
why tariffs are a disaster if he slows the economy down.
Long term, all of this is corrosive to democracy. I mean, it's a terrible thing what he did. But we're from a hack perspective, he's just making cynical judgments about what he can get away with, and he thinks he can
in the short term
get away with this. And he listen, I said last night on TV, you know, in some ways it was a very honorable thing he did because he was the guy who sent them there.
He's made on the basis of the way he campaigned and what he promised to do, he paid no short-term political price for promising to pardon them. And so he apparently determined that he was going to pay no political price for actually pardoning them. I will just say in a non-hackish way, if this was any other country, we would be talking about how this is a standard move of an autocrat who had just freed the paramilitaries. That's what we would say in another country. We would be talking about how this is the paramilitary guard. He let out the Oath Keepers.
Putin would be saying, not bad, chapter four. He's learning.
Yes, seriously. That's what we would be saying.
As he would about, the executive order to protect free speech, i.e., don't allow there to be any sort of
free speech.
No fact checking. But yeah. This is from a guy who said you should be jailed if you criticize Eileen Cannon, the judge. That, if you criticize judges who are friendly to me, that actually should be a crime. And he's a champion of free speech.
This is the guy who's suing a pollster for a poll he didn't like. For a poll he didn't like, okay?
Yeah. Epically wrong, but yeah.
But still!
I know. Next they'll start suing podcast blowhards, and then we're all going to have to move to Canada.
Look, John, I take all your points. I mean, there's no doubt that this is a guy. Part of not believing in rules and laws and norms and institutions is you don't really believe in democracy because all of that, it depends on all that, and he's sundering all of them to his own advantage. Let's just stipulate that. But on the politics of it, I think he probably, if he delivers on the fundamental thing, which is lowering people's costs and people feel like they're, safer, the border, he'll get a lot of leeway on this other stuff.
Yeah, it can go two ways. I mean, this thing, I think it is not so complicated. One is if he does do the tariff stuff, and there's massive incompetence and everything, it'll start to grind at him. And by the way, the House R's are like, go, MAGA, go. By the way, we're going to lose in 2 years. And this guy's going to make it worse if he has a chain of trouble. And the tariffs are the worst thing. Or the tariffs are a bluff. He doesn't do the crazy stuff there. The Fed is good to him, big if. Energy prices tick down a little bit because he's going to flood the supply. You do too much of that, by the way, you get a big oil collapse, but let's see what happens. And then his happy days are here again. He'll still probably lose the House on the cycles, but he'll run against the Dems and it'll be okay for him.
Footnote on the oil stuff. It takes years for these things to actually come online.
No kidding.
And a lot of these companies are not, there's a lot of this territory that he's freeing up that they're not going to want to explore. So the notion that that's going to have some sort of immediate effect is...
No, I'm not saying that, but he will be able to knock up oil production quicker than normal. But that lowers oil prices, which cuts off oil investment. The oil thing is cyclical.
We're already at record levels of production here.
Right. Oh, more can happen. I have no doubt.
Let me ask you guys this question, okay? So the other striking thing about yesterday, obviously, was the tableau of corporate upsuckery, and in particularly the tech bros, right, who were all over his inaugural speech. There are members of Congress who couldn't bring their spouses, the tech bros, the tech billionaires, the Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs and the Elon Musks, and all those people were able to bring their spouses. And there were governors who were like in overflow rooms, right? Trump basically presented this tableau. He loves the fact that all these billionaires are sucking up to him the way that they are. And some of the other things we've talked about here advertise the degree of kind of oligarchic corruption that's going to be on display over the next 4 years. The question I have for the two of you is this. I think, like, if you were to take a poll of the consultant class right now, a Democratic consultant class right now, they would say this is what Democrats need to fashion their message around. The notion that Trump is really another version, a more exaggerated version of he's not in it for you. He's just in it to make himself rich and his cronies rich. And that's the message that they have to just focus on that for the next 2 years to try to win back control of the House. The question is, I think you guys would agree that that's a core conventional wisdom now of the consultant class. Do you agree with it?
Yeah, no, listen, I think they're half right. Now, Mike won't, because he's from the old Republican Party where they embrace They embrace the plutocrats.
What we used to do with all the big corporations, we'd wait for like an Obama to win and give them millions for the inaugural. And now the crypto bros are flying in for it. A corporate stock upery is not new. I like that Trump's motives are him, but I want to hear about failure. I want to hold him to those expectations
right.
on the economy.
So I think that's half right, John, because I mean, the fact is when people, when they get hip to the fact that when he talks about draining the swamp, he's talking about draining it into his right into his own pocket and the pocket of his friends. That's going to piss them off. But especially if they're not benefiting, if they don't see benefits themselves. But the Democratic Party, it's not just about what Trump does. I think the Democratic Party has to recognize its own trust issue. The fact of the matter is that Democrats programmatically generally are right on for this working class voters. They just culturally and attitudinally, it's like I've said it a million times that, you know, we're missionaries coming to help you become more like us. And by the way, when you become more enlightened, you'll get the whole, you know, all the social issues too. You'll when you're college educated, you'll understand, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The postmodernist construct will really impress you here in the welding pit. But look at that. Trump is leaving a lot of DIA traps in some of this stuff. Many things I oppose. But the Dems may take that bait and give him another fight that's good for him.
Yeah.
Trump would love to fight on culture with the Democratic elite, and they love to fall for that every single time.
Culture is the shiny object that he points people to, you know, while they're draining the swamp into their own pockets. So I think that it's a lazy sort of construct and to say all we have to do is paint Trump as a tool of the plutocrats and we will win.
Yeah, workers of the world unite. They've tried that.
But you guys got off of something too quickly.
You know, guys, I have to apologize. I got to go. I'm here and I'm working and I've got to work on my new identity to stay out of Trump thought police. So if you guys can land the plane,
the toupee is very handsome, by the way.
Yeah,
I like
No. And I'm going with the beard. I got a couple of costumes here. All right. Love you, brother. See you next week. Hang on, America.
We'll talk to you later.
Later,
all
Mike.
Right. Bye.
So, John,
you're trying to remember the thing that we got off of too quickly.
Well, no, I remember what it was.
What is
and
it?
I don't want to, you know,
what was
we've pounded the Biden shit to death.
Yeah.
But that was egregious. The 10 minutes before the inauguration, they announced that he's pardoned members of his family. I mean, man up. You know what I mean? Man up. And if you're going to do it, do it. But don't do it literally as you have one foot out the door so you don't have to explain it or be accountable for it. And what they did was they gave Trump a gift because it fuzzied up the story, the J6 story for him. And you heard him last night. You mentioned it. That's what made me think about it. I mean, could you end a presidency as badly as he has? I mean, Trump did. So let's say that.
I was going to say,
yeah,
he didn't foment an insurrection at the Capitol.
Yes. So he's better than that. Yes.
It's been shambolic, and it's amazing how like little coordination there is. They just seem to be kind of like they're doing all these things they did on the way out the door in a very kind of higgledy-piggledy way. There was no messaging coordination. There was no work with any allies. There was no work with other Democrats. They didn't do, it seemed like the whole thing just fell apart at the end. I will say,
this thing, John, it made the thing look particularly sleazy.
Yes, I know. I totally agree. And look, let's give the guy credit. He got the ceasefire done.
Yeah.
So he did some things, and I love some of the pardon work he did. I love the stuff. I mean, on the merits, I love the idea of the fact that he, you know, commuted all of those death row sentences or converted them all into life imprisonment.
Well, the powdered versus
especially the death row sentences, though, which I think
is a
very principled thing to do. Life without parole is a very fine sentence. I really, as you know, because we talked about it, I really objected.
He commuted three of them. So
Right.
I think he commuted all of them, I guess, except for three. He left three on death row, and he commuted the rest.
So I said before, you know, when we talked about this time, I hated the Hunter Biden pardon, and I hated it because he promised not to do it.
Right.
And I on the substance and on the politics of it.
Right.
Okay, number one. Number two, on the merits, given the threats that have been issued at the members of the J6 committee and at his family over and over again, on the merits, I don't have as much of a problem with the prophylactic preemptive pardons of those people. But I agree with you, the timing was terrible on the politics, and I agree with you, it showed a lack of balls. I mean, he's president of the United States.
Yeah, just man the hell up and say, you know, I'm doing it because this guy threatened my family, threatened these people who are doing their jobs.
I agree.
And we are not going to, I mean, man up.
Well, and just in terms of the politics of it, if he'd done it 2 weeks ago, was he going to get some shit for it? But who cares? I mean, who cares if people were going to give him a hard time? He could have stood up and said, explained it the way he's going to explain it, and it wouldn't have given Trump the cover, the ability to do what he did on the same day. Like that is, to me, a gift he gave to Trump that he could easily have withheld from Trump politically by announcing these a week ago, yeah, 3 days ago, 10 days ago, pick your day, any day but the day of the inauguration, when it looked like it looked skeezy. And as I say, it allowed Trump to do a false equivalency, and it's just terrible.
It was mind-boggling to me that they did it the way they did it. But, you know, I don't think he, at this point, really cares.
And do you think the explanation for that is, I mean, look, what I think we would both agree, Joe Biden, in some areas, Joe Biden's political team committed some very significant long-term, his world historical malpractice. But his White House staff is full of very smart people, and they're very good, and they've been very good. You know, like it's not an incompetent White House. Do you think it's just at the end that the staff just lost control and he was just making these decisions, basically anything related to his family and some of these pardons were just like he was doing this on his own? Because I can't imagine his office of legal counsel and the comms shop and the rest of his political shop didn't see some of these things coming, that this would be a problem politically.
Well, John, at this point, I can't even raise an eyebrow, you know, and say, wow, I can't believe that they would make a mistake like this. There have been so many mistakes over such a long period of time. And you know, I don't know. I mean, there's smart people around him. And I don't know whether it's, you know, they got so used to accommodating him that, you know, I mean, the least savvy politician when it comes to this stuff in the group is Joe Biden. And that was probably true before he age overcame him. But, you know, he does have people around him who I think have enabled him. And they didn't do him any. This looks like a thing that was called by the family and they went along, you know, but boy, oh boy, it was a mistake. It was really a mistake.
Allow me to join with Amy Klobuchar and others who, having watched this whole spectacle, I went back and looked this up yesterday, by the way, which is, you know, Trump in his first term did roughly the amount of pardons that Obama did, you know, and that George W. Bush, there was a kind of a, you know, these Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, all kind of between 190 and like 300 pardons, basically. They're like, they're not a really wide band. Trump didn't go crazy at the end mm-hmm. of his first term. I imagine now that my first thought yesterday was that he's going to pardon like a list of people at the end of this, over the course of this term, that's going to be like the length of the Manhattan phone book.
Well, you know, listen, he's been immunized by the U.S. Supreme Court. And now I think that this notion of preemptive pardons is now, this is the problem when you destroy norms.
And precedents.
Very hard precedents. To resemble.
Just destroy a norm, set a new precedent, and now it's fucking anarchy out there. And that's why, as I'm watching all this, I am now with Amy Klobuchar, who's like, we need to fix the pardon system. Like, there's got to be, let's figure out some way to reform this pardon thing, because it's always been ripe for abuse. And one of the things that you are making, the point you're making about Trump, is that what Trump has learned over time is that, like, norm schmorms. If it's not a law, like, what are you telling me? Democracy depends on norms? What's a norm? A norm is some thing, some precedent, some values-based thing. Like, what happens if I break it? Nothing? Okay. Let's just knock them down.
The one thing about Donald Trump, and I've said it before, the words that will not pass from his lips are, well, we could do it, but it would be wrong.
Right.
That is not in his range of thought.
And, or we could do it, but or we shouldn't do it because that's just not how it's done.
Right. I mean, his thing is you do whatever you can to get whatever you want. And the only thing you can do that's wrong is not doing the thing that's in your self-interest.
Right. And wait for someone to stop me. Like, hey, yeah. Someone wants to try to stop me. Try to stop me is his basic approach,
which is dangerous. It's dangerous for the country. It's a dangerous impulse in a president. It's dangerous for the country, dangerous for the world. And as we said earlier, an unbridled Trump, a hubristic Trump who feels like he is there are no guardrails. You know, it's going to be challenging. One thing, by the way, before we get to mail, because we should do mail, the one thing that Caitlin Collins made a great catch last night, as you know, because they flooded with these. I mean, there are a couple of executive orders that didn't get enough attention. You know, they're going to fire a whole, based on the order that he signed, they're going to try and fire a whole bunch of folks who are career government people, and they're going to try and replace them with political appointees. The Schedule F move that he tried to do at the end of his last administration, taking jobs that have civil service protection and essentially designating them as what is effectively a political appointment, that is going to be a story that has watched. That sort of slipped through the discussion last night because there was so much else going on.
So much else
the other
going
thing
on.
Was that she found was this executive order that basically gives him the ability to designate anyone for an interim period as recipients of top secret information, whether they pass, you know, before they pass the requisite background checks. So he can basically say, you know, Elon Musk should see, he needs to see these documents. Anybody else needs to see these documents. That's my reading of it. So there are all kinds of things going on here, and he flooded the zone. So it's going to take time for all of those things to permeate. But speaking of time.
And speaking of floods and permeation and zones, yeah?
Yes, maybe we should flood the zone with some mail. All right. If you have questions for the Hacks, send them to hacksontap@gmail.com. Or better yet, because people are not apparently using our crack voicemail system, read your questions to us so we can hear your voices and the emotion and the passion that you bring to these questions, and we can check out that you're not ringers. So to do that, just call this number.
773-389-4471. I'll repeat it because who can remember that? 773-389-4471.
I love that, John, because, you know, I miss Mike when he slips off like that, and then I can hear his voice again, and it just, it's really good.
It's warm, it's comforting, it's reassuring. I also love AI Mike. It's just, that's a very good kind of
Mike. AI Mike is great.
AI Mike, he also doesn't talk back, which is sort of nice. You let him, he says his piece, and then we can say whatever the fuck we want. And there's no more bullshit Mike kind of like. Hey, I have a question to read to you.
And, yes.
I'm just gonna select your question for you.
Ready? All right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
This is a question that we have from Anne in the listener mailbag. Okay.
Yes.
Do political consultants, aka strategists, aka hatchet men, such as yourself, formerly, do they ever struggle when a client they dislike prevails in an election? Will a political strategist turn down offers from potential clients who they do not think can serve in the position they are interested in running for, or do they leave that up to the voters? Those are two kind of conjoined questions, basically asking the question of whether you have any heart, soul, or ethics as a class.
Yeah. Well, I hope I defy the stereotype here. I used to fire clients all the time, and I would refuse clients, particularly as I moved up in my career. You know, I was involved in a governor's race once with a candidate whose, when I got into it, lack of depth on some things that he should have known were so shocking to me that a guy was running for governor, and I quit the race.
I like how you changed it to a guy, given that I know it was Sarah Palin.
No, it was a guy. Okay. And but I've told this story publicly. I personally, you know, I represented Rob Blagojevich when he ran for Congress, and I liked Rod, and in many ways I still like Rod very much. But he was, when he came to me and said he wanted to run for governor, I was kind of, oh, I don't know about this. And I said, well, why do you want to run for governor? He said, well, you can help me figure that out. And I said, if I have to help you figure this out, you should really think about whether this is the right thing to do. And he said, come on, we're going to raise a lot of money. It's going to be fun. And I said, no, man, I'm out.
You said I'm too busy helping Barack Obama figure out what he wants to do as president.
The truth of that is that I did not work for him, and and then the summer of 2002, he hired another firm that was a highly proficient firm. They ran a very smart campaign because the last governor was going to prison too, and so they ran as a reformer. You know, I'm a reform candidate. They ran as an anti-establishment reform kind of campaign, and by the summer of 2002, it was clear to me that he was going to win. And I found that, you know, as I said, I really, as a person, I really, you know, Rod was fun. I think he did have actually a sense of everyday people that a lot of that some politicians lack. He was funny. He was very kind to my family. But I was kind of appalled because of what I knew about him and a lack of seriousness. And at that moment, literally as I was brooding about whether I should stay in consulting, I got a call from Barack Obama, who was a state senator, who was a friend of mine, who had just lost a campaign for Congress by like 30 points, a primary. And he said, I got one race left in me. And I told Michelle, it's up or out, you know, and I want to run for the Senate. And that's how that all began. So, I thought if I could help Barack Obama get elected to the U.S. Senate, that would revive my sense of idealism. And so it was really serendipitous that he called when he did, because I was really thinking about getting out of the business. So there's your answer, Anne.
I was going to say, it's like there's that phrase, like a door closes, a window opens. In that
exactly.
Case, in that case, it was like a doorway to hell and a stairway to heaven.
Absolutely true. Bill John Heilman writes, I'm piggybacking on a great piece by David Brooks in the New York Times called We Deserve Pete Hegseth, among many points. And it really was, I thought it was a very good column. A key one he made, I'd like your take on, is how Dems are still hammering away at points of character and morality when they should be addressing competence and qualification. In your opinion, who is going to lead this shift to addressing the inevitable incompetence of Trump and his cabinet, and how should it be done? I want to just amend it just a little bit. I thought that the focus on his sort of personal, you know, obviously sexual assault is one thing, but about, you know, his wife and cheating on his wife and all of that stuff, I thought was sort of unproductive. It sort of led them down the wrong path. This is a guy who is wholly unqualified. So, I mean, I'm wondering what you thought about that.
Well, what I thought about that is that I have thought from the very first day that Donald Trump got reelected that you have to have an incredible miscreant for all of his nominations not to get confirmed, and that the only way it would be an incredible miscreant would have to take himself out of the race. I was shocked that he picked Matt Gaetz. I stand by my notion that there's a possibility that Gaetz had stayed in, that he might have actually gotten confirmed. And I think that it's a good question. I remember we talked about this with Governor Christie at the time, you know, about what the focus on the I don't even want to call these peccadilloes. I mean, like the man, it's like, you know, with Hegseth, this is a little bit like, you know, come for this, for the white nationalism, stay for the sexual assault. I mean, the guy's got all kinds of problems. Those are not small things, you know, being an alcoholic, being someone who's the accusations of drinking on the job, his pledge to quit drinking if he becomes Secretary of Defense. I mean, these are things that have in the past, John Tower, for example, there was the things that took them down. And he's obviously not qualified for the job, but I just don't believe fundamentally on the basis of history that there's any reason to think that Senate Republicans were going to grow enough of a spine to stop any of these people. And I think whether it's Hegseth or Gabbard or Kash Patel or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I'm not saying it's impossible, but like other than John McCain on the Affordable Care Act, can anybody please name me an example of a time where Republicans who were under pressure to do something Donald Trump wanted stood up to him and didn't give him his way? There is no other example besides John McCain on health care in 2017. So there's no precedent for it. I think they're all going to get through.
The question is really what was the most, I think there are certain elements of his personal life that were keenly relevant. And I mean, the sexual assault thing is really important because that has been a problem for the military. But, you know, alcoholism in a Secretary of Defense, a guy, you know, with those weighty responsibilities is a particularly concerning thing. White nationalist.
Yeah, I know. I was making a joke.
But I mean, I'm not saying that all of it is irrelevant. I'm saying that, you know, I remember when Dale Bumpers was defending Bill Clinton in the Senate in 1999, or 98, whatever year it was, 99, I guess by this time, on the whole issue about Monica Lewinsky. And he said, you know, I know a lot of the proponents of this impeachment say it's not about sex. He said, and let me tell you something, when people says it's not about the sex, it's about the sex.
About the sex, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I just think, especially given all the other, you know, stuff that we've gone through lately, that became sort of a diversion.
Just to be specific about it, I thought Tim Kaine's line of questioning was out of character for Tim Kaine and not productive. I thought Mark Kelly's line of questioning when he went through all the reported instances.
Yes, that was productive.
And made Hegseth say that these are all scandal, they're all anonymous slurs or whatever he had to say. He said it over and over again, but he never denied any of them. And then at the end, when Kelly said, if you were under oath, would you change your testimony? And Hegseth basically refused to answer. I thought that was actually a very effective line of questioning. It got Hegseth to basically acknowledge that all of these things were true without, in a skillful way.
There's no doubt he was a falling down drunk. Hegseth would have been better to sort of continue down the line he went in his opening statement and say,
yes, I was, but I found God. I found God. I'm reformed. Like a lot of people in America.
Like a lot of veterans, I came back from the war and I had problems. And
like a lot of non-veterans, to say,
right,
yes, I had a problem with alcoholism, like 20, like a billion people, whatever the number is, you know, like tens of millions of Americans. I had a problem with alcohol. I am now reformed. I went into a program. I've come out the other side. But with the help of my God and my sponsor,
yeah, that would have been more compelling.
I've now moved past it.
Two other people who I thought senators who did quite well were Tammy Duckworth, who basically elicited from him like
that
a stunning lack of depth.
Yes, I mean
couldn't answer basic questions about global security organizations and
his invocation of three countries not in ASEAN in a question about the members of ASEAN was really quite yes. something. You don't usually get the gotcha questions usually work quite that well, but that one really did.
And then I thought Alyssa Slotkin was good and sort
superb,
of, challenging him on whether he would refuse an illegal order.
Not surprisingly, the female veterans turned out to be very, very good, which is why, of course, Joni Ernst, if she were not just like every other goddamn Republican. If it, like, you know, Joni Ernst would have been the nail in his coffin because she, I'm sure, if she had done a job where she was actually trying to interrogate him to actually make a judgment about his fitness for the office, whether it's on qualifications or on personal, on some of these character issues, I think Joni Ernst would have eviscerated. If she just talked about her history in the military and talked about her history as a sexual assault survivor, she would have, you know, reduced him to rubble. But she was not interested in doing that for a variety of reasons that have everything to do with why all of these nominations are likely to get confirmed.
Yeah. Speaking of putting a nail in things, we got to put a nail in this. We are going to have an interesting 4 years here. And again, you know, I think we should not spare judgment on some of the things that Trump does relative to, you know, democracy, relative to, you know, the probity and integrity of government and so on. But it's going to be an interesting political spectacle as well. And that's what people expect from hacks like us.
Hey, if I was more, if I was inclined to be cliched, I'd do that Chinese proverb, you know, that says, like, may you live in interesting times. What it really means is, boy, you're fucked. But I'm not that, I just look at it and think.
No, you would not do a cliched thing like that.
I think one of the things is to, you know, I, people have now gotten on this thing of, last thing I'll say, on this thing of, like, pay attention to what Trump does, not to what he says. And I think that's, it's kind of intuitively and instinctively appealing, but whether it's on the political side or on the normative substantive side, the problem is that Trump, you know, as with the J6 pardons, he both says it and does it. It's a false binary. The thing is, he says a lot more things than he actually does. But it's part of the interesting thing is trying to figure out which of those things are the things where he announces what he's going to do and then he does it, and which of them count. You know, it's like more of a signal to noise problem rather than a what he says versus what he does problem.
Well, we're over here, but I'll just say as a final point, when you're president, what you say is as important as what you do in some ways, because presidents, when they speak, can send armies marching and markets tumbling. And so that is, you know, we got to pay attention to both. But we also have to pay attention to the clock here, brother. So,
David, may you live in interesting times.
Oh, there you did do it.
Yeah, I had to.
Thank you. See you, brother.
Later, man.